A new and big issue has arisen for school districts across Illinois and the nation: how to create policies that provide trans students access to bathrooms.
Had there been any policy, it would have made a whole lot of difference for my life, because I think I would have understood at a younger age that it was okay to feel whatever I was feeling.
We'll hear from Jordy Yanez about his work with schools across central Illinois. And we'll also talk to a lawyer from the Alliance Defending Freedom. He'll explain why they're suing a suburban Chicago school district and the Department of Education for allowing trans students to use the bathroom they choose. On a lighter note, the bison may soon become the national mammal.
As one congressman put it, no other species tells America's story better than this noble creature.
Today, we'll answer the question, what do particle physics and bison conservation have in common? Fermilab has the answer. That's all this hour on the 21st. Stay tuned. Welcome to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. It's been all over the news this week. Transgender students in some parts of the state have been granted access to use bathrooms and locker rooms that match their gender identity. The most recent announcement came from Chicago Public Schools on Tuesday. It was followed yesterday by a countersuit from a group representing 51 families in the northwest suburbs of Chicago, saying that these policies are a violation of privacy and Title IX laws, which they say doesn't cover a gender identity. We're going to talk about all of this with many involved in the issue today on the 21st, where we're all about conversation. So for everyone listening, you're always welcome to share your questions or comments. I know this is a passionate issue, so I'm going to ask that everyone remember that we want this to be a respectful conversation of all sides. With that said, give us a call. The phone number is 1-800-222-9455. You can tweet to 21st Show. Again, our phone number, 1-800-222-9455. Joining us now first to talk about this issue is Jordy Yanez. Jordy is a Central Illinois Program Coordinator for the Illinois Safe Schools Alliance. He's on the line from Peoria, where he's based. Jordy, welcome to the 21st.
Hello, how are you doing today?
Good, thank you. We're also joining us as well as Christopher Clark from Chicago. He's an attorney for Lambda Legal. Christopher, thanks for being with us as well.
Thank you for having me.
Jordy, let's start with you. I really would love to hear your reaction. You went to Chicago Public Schools for high schools. You graduated in 2004, so of course before the new policy this week. And I wanted to ask you first what your reaction was to the news this week about CPS and what the new policy is for CPS schools.
I am overfilled with joy, really. I mean, CPS is really setting the stepping stone for everybody else, is really stating what we've been working for at the Alliance and pretty much being themselves a role model for other districts. And I'm honestly overjoyed with what they're doing. I think it's a great decision that they've made, being that they are such a big district.
Mm-hmm. How would a policy like the one CPS just announced have made a difference for you personally when you were in school?
It would have changed my life in a huge component. I mean, if you go to school to worry about anything else but school, it really causes a lot of stressors. And I wish I would have had the opportunity to just go to school and focus on my studies instead of trying to figure out who I could be seeking support of in my teachers, or how would I be getting away from bullying in the school that had to be related with my gender identity or my sexual orientation. There was a lack of education and understanding at the time for the LGBTQ community.
Mm-hmm.
And I think policies as this one would have really definitely made a positive impact in my life and experience in shirts.
When you say that, I wonder if you can describe for us how it sounds like it was a really tough and isolating experience. Can you give us specific examples of how it was? This was back in 2004. I mean, was this just a situation where no one talked about these issues with you and you felt worried about talking about them with anyone else?
I think that when you go, and mostly, I mean, speaking for a personal state, when you go to school and you don't see yourself reflected in what you're learning, or there is no conversation from your teachers or support networks that are supposed to be in place, talking about LGBTQ matters or anything of LGBTQ in your curriculum, I didn't have that chance. So it makes you feel like you're not normal, like you're not part of history, which now we know this is all obviously not true. We are, as the LGBTQ community, a huge part of history and the present. But I didn't have a chance in growing up to see those lessons in my books or in anything. So it makes you feel like you're not welcome to talk about who you are and what you're going through when you're supposed to be in a welcoming environment and a place that you feel safe at. So I became very secluded as a young person because I felt like there was going to be no understanding of what I was going through, and maybe reached the point where I thought there was something wrong with me because there was nobody there to talk to. And in growing up and doing my own learning, I realized that this is completely normal, I'm completely fine, and I'm glad CPS is putting things in place so that this doesn't happen anymore and students feel welcome to express exactly who they are and ask questions and know that there will be support in their educational environments.
That's Jordy Yanez. He's the Central Illinois Program Coordinator for the Illinois Safe Schools Alliance, joining us from Peoria. On the line from Chicago, Christopher Clark with Lambda Legal. Christopher, it sounds like Jordy's saying that a lot of these policies are really a proxy for a larger conversation about LGBTQ issues in schools. Would you say that that's an accurate way to describe it?
Yes, and we are also thrilled that Chicago Public Schools has issued the guidelines that it issued this week and is providing a safer, more affirming, and more welcoming environment for LGBTQ students, and particularly transgender and gender nonconforming students. And so it's a great step in the right direction, and it's the guidelines are addressing a lot of the issues that are faced in schools by our most vulnerable students. But one thing that I think is very important to keep in mind as we talk about this is that these guidelines are really bringing the Chicago Public Schools, are reflecting what is required under the law. So we do have both state and federal laws that do require schools to allow transgender and gender nonconforming students to use restrooms, locker rooms, and other sex-segregated facilities in a manner consistent with their gender identities. And these guidelines that were issued by CPS are reflective of that law.
Can you explain a little bit of they're reflective of the law, but are there policies in place statewide? Or is it up to each school district or school to create policies that, as you say, conform with what the federal law is?
Sure. The specific policies that take place within a given school or school district are created at the local level, which is usually a good thing in the sense that it allows schools to create the specifics of the policies that work within their various school districts. But those must be created within the sort of framework of overarching law. And you've got a couple of laws that are significant and in place here.
Right. We've heard a lot about Title IX. Can you explain how that applies here?
Sure. So Title IX is a federal law that prohibits discrimination in the school context on the basis of, among other things, sex. And the Department of Education, the federal agency that sort of enforces and interprets Title IX, has stated that it is a form of sex discrimination to refuse to allow transgender students to use restrooms and locker rooms that are inconsistent with their gender identity. So in other words, schools do have to allow transgender students to use the appropriate restroom. So you have a federal law and a federal agency interpreting and enforcing that law that basically says that what Chicago Public Schools is issuing in its guidelines is what is required under federal law. So that's kind of the federal or national landscape on this. And then we have a Illinois law, the Illinois Human Rights Act, that prohibits discrimination in schools on the basis of sex, sexual orientation, and gender identity. And so to be in compliance with that law, schools, again, have to allow transgender students and gender nonconforming students to use restrooms and locker rooms in a manner consistent with their gender identity.
Jordy, what resources are available for trans students who attend a school if there isn't a policy in place regarding bathrooms and locker rooms?
Well, a huge resource that I will be proud to talk about is the Illinois Safe Schools Alliance. we are able to advocate for students and parents and let them know what the rights are, how they can address the administration. And we love to talk to different districts and schools directly about best practices that they could put in place to support their students. I think that a huge portion of this is a lack of understanding of what they can do or cannot do, even though the law is very clear. And we just help facilitate the understanding on how to put these processes in place and just provide professional development training, youth advocacy, and different supports to other services, such as one of the biggest supporters that we have is Lurie Children's Hospital, who's also placed policy in place to assist those that need guidance.
Did you say Lurie Children's Hospital?
Yes.
Okay. Christopher, as you're talking about, as Jordy's talking about different professional training, how does the process work right now in terms of, as this is, I imagine you've probably seen in the past 9 to 12 months a lot more movement on this issue than you ever have. And I wonder, how are districts reaching out? What's the responsibility of a district?
You are seeing more and more districts around the country reaching out to organizations like the Illinois Safe Schools Alliance, like our organization, and really similar organizations around the country to get some guidance on what are the appropriate policies and guidelines in the school that will both be bring the school district in compliance with federal and perhaps state law, and also, more importantly even, what is the appropriate guideline that will be the best for the students in that school. So we are seeing, within the last year or so, many, many more schools sort of reaching out and trying to figure out the best way to do the right thing. And then you also have schools that unfortunately do not do the right thing. And then so in those instances, we have seen some litigation surrounding this issue, and I suspect that we're going to see more of that.
I do want to talk about the litigation that was announced yesterday in a minute, but I want to ask about, as you said, are there particular districts throughout Illinois where you feel like, from Lambda Legal's perspective, are not cooperating on this issue?
No, I mean, we have worked with school districts, and certainly the Illinois Safe Schools Alliance has worked with school districts in order to educate school administrators and school boards and get them to do the right thing. So you know, not every school district at this time has a specific policy in place, but they're all subject to federal and state law. And, you know, we remain firmly committed to working with any and all districts to, you know, reduce to writing into a policy that which is required under the law, and you know, we're willing to engage with people, educate school officials, and do some training in schools in conjunction with organizations like the Illinois Safe Schools Alliance, and really make this happen all across the state.
Jordy, when you hear from transgender high school students across the state, what are they saying? What are they asking for?
They are asking for us to intervene with their administration and just kind of show them what resources they can provide so that they can be more comfortably attending school. And a lot of the times we connect with them to provide professional development trainings for teachers, counselors, superintendents, etc. And this alleviates a lot of what is the lack of education in order to assess the needs for transgender students. And then we can, depending on the district, we can provide policy guidance and just different examples of things that they can put in place so that this case-by-case, help for each student can be on a safe manner and cannot be discriminatory in any matter.
Christopher, would Lambda Legal like to see a statewide policy on this issue? Is this something you all are advocating for?
You know, that would certainly be helpful because it would send additional guidance to local school districts. But you know, we're confident that as we continue this work, we're going to see more and more school districts across the state sort of putting these policies into place. And you know, that's another way to get to where we need to be.
Jordy, you're based in Peoria. We started this conversation by you talking about how you think Chicago is setting an example for the rest of the state. When you're looking at high schools in the rest of the state, are there differences you notice in terms of the culture or willingness to accept and support trans students?
I feel like the central Illinois area can be a little more reluctant, but it is on a case-by-case basis where they can be very proactive or not. I mean, right now we have a huge win for Williamsville District where the superintendent, David Root, you know, he made a very good decision and agreed with Alex McCray to have the settlement and put policy in place that only supports the well-being of transgender students in that district, and that's in a very rural area, central Illinois. So I think it really does depend on the district and their willingness to be proactive and put policies in place. Williamsville was a really good example of a great policy that can be put in place and very well support any and all students that will go through that district.
Was that led, Jordy, by students, or how did that come about?
Yes, that was actually led by Alex McCray, who is a student at the Williamsville High School. He decided that this was the right step to do and put movements in place to get to where he needed to get to have access to the facilities that affirm his gender. And the school settled with him. And now he is able to utilize the facilities that affirms him and be recognized by his gender and legal names and everything. And this was something that was led by him. And nobody else can take credit, really, but himself and those of the...
For that. Yeah. Thanks for that, Jordy. We're gonna pick up this conversation in just a few minutes. You're listening to The 21st.
The 21st is made possible by the Library at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign, fostering discovery by providing information curation and archival services to extend scholarly impact from Urbana-Champaign to the state, the nation, and the world. The University Library at Illinois.
Listening to the 21st, I'm Nyla Boodoo. Right now, we're talking about transgender students being given access to bathrooms that match their gender identity. This story is being played out in a number of Illinois communities across the country with news yesterday about North Carolina, part of a national conversation. In a few minutes, we're going to be speaking with the lead attorney from a lawsuit that was filed yesterday on behalf of dozens of families in the Chicago suburbs who disagree with the new policies that schools have been implemented. Right now, I'm speaking with Jordy Yanez. He's a Central Illinois Program Coordinator for the Illinois Safe Schools Alliance. He's joining us from Peoria. On the line from Chicago, Christopher Clark is an attorney with Lambda Legal. You're welcome to join our conversation as well. Our phone number is 1-800-222-9455. You can tweet us to 21st Show. That's 21ST Show. Right before the break, Jordy, you were talking about Williamsville, just north of Springfield, and saying they're really doing things right. And I wanted to ask you, what specifically are they doing? Is it involving parents? Is it in having in the entire school in a conversation? What do you see from your perspective for Illinois Safe Schools as what Williamsville is doing right?
I think the fact that they have settled on this policy that implements different procedures to affirm transgender students in the district gives an open environment for those LGBTQ-identified students to know that they are welcome in their district, to know that they can ask questions and go to their teachers, counselors, social workers, even the superintendent, and be able to really talk about what they're going through and know that there are procedures in place to support them and help them as to what they're discovering in their life. So I think that that's a huge step because it eliminates the stressors from students having to go to school to an environment that they do not feel welcomed at, and they still have to worry about learning all these different things when they have different stressors going through their head during the day.
Right. I know there's I know there's a gender support team for LGBTQ students. What does that involve?
The gender support team is a support group that is encompassed of the different personnel within the school. So it can be the administrators, faculty, staff, students. But it's mainly centered to support the student as to the process that they're going through, and you can examine different things as to who is an adult person within the school that can be supportive of them as they're going through the day and they might have encountered a bullying incident. Or they can sit down as a group and explore the best options that are for the student. Let's say somebody that wants to be able to have access to male facilities because that's their affirmed facilities, then this group sits together and analyzes the situation and the safety concerns and everything to best support the student. This is all based on what the student needs and what the student wants. But this group basically helps through this process and stays together for the duration of the student's stay in that district.
Christopher Clark, are we seeing these policies happen only at the high school level, or are we seeing this for younger age teenagers and children? I don't know if that is in Illinois or in other parts of the country.
You are, both in Illinois and across the country, starting to see this conversation and policies implemented at the middle school and even some education in the elementary school levels, because what we are seeing is that, in fact, there are transgender students who are struggling with issues as early as the elementary school level, and it's important for those students and their families' well-being for there to be a safe and affirming place in school for those students. Because the truth of the matter is LGBT students are at a much, much higher risk of the type of bullying that Jordy referenced, both, verbal harassment, physical harassment, and even physical assault in schools. The numbers are still far too high, both in Illinois and across the country. And, of course, bullying and violence directed at students has a profoundly negative impact on that student's education. So it's very important to get policies in place at an early age so that students can feel safe and welcomed in their schools.
Yesterday, we saw some pushback against these policies from the Chicago suburbs. An organization called the Alliance Defending Freedom said that 51 families were suing not just the school district in the Palatine. It's Palatine, Schaumburg, Hoffman Estates, District 211, but also the Department of Education. And they said that this was a violation of privacy, as well as they believe a violation of Title IX. Christopher, what's your response to that? What are past legal cases saying about the fact that Title IX applies to only male and female and doesn't include perhaps gender identity?
So in January of 2015, the Department of Education's Office of Civil Rights, again the federal agency that enforces and interprets Title IX, issued a statement saying that Title IX's prohibition of discrimination based on sex includes discrimination against transgender individuals, and that therefore schools must permit transgender students to use restrooms and locker rooms consistent with their gender identity. So that is the federal agency that is enforcing this law. As a couple of weeks ago, the Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals, this is a federal court of appeals, the court level directly below the Supreme Court, affirmed that guidance that was issued by the Department of Education. So now we have a federal court of appeals that has chimed in on this issue. And as you alluded to earlier, just yesterday, the United States Department of Justice sent a letter to the governor of North Carolina indicating that that state's recent law, which attempts to prohibit transgender students from using the appropriate restroom, is in violation of federal law. So, it is becoming pretty clear that the position that the Alliance Defending Freedom is trying to assert in this recent lawsuit is completely inconsistent with federal law. So we expect that ultimately a judge will reach that conclusion in that case as well.
We heard parents yesterday at the press conference say that they don't want their children exposed to genitalia in locker rooms. What's your response to that?
My understanding is that in the specific school district that is the subject of that lawsuit, there is an option for students who do not want to get undressed or dressed in front of other students to use a private stall or area within the locker room to accomplish that. And, you know, I believe that students can use locker rooms in a way that is not going to that is not going to interfere with their privacy. So, you know, we know what goes on in locker rooms. People go in, they change their clothes, and then they go to gym class. The suggestion that that transgender students are somehow presenting a risk or danger to other students is completely absurd, and there are no facts to support those kinds of allegations.
Jordy, you know, I wanted to ask you just one last question about if you feel like there's a much bigger issue here than just the bathroom and locker room issue that's been kind of dominating the media spotlight in the past couple of weeks. Do you feel like the media is maybe missing the point, or maybe really everyone is, by just focusing on locker rooms and bathrooms?
I do think so, to a point that we're missing the point. The point that we are, as the Illinois Safe Schools Alliance, we are really thinking of this as just human rights. You know, we're trying to advocate for human rights, rights that are being violated for transgender students. And Chris really clarified how the law is for us, so I don't understand all the different questions that are happening around it. And I think it's a lack of education that, just like Lambda Legal, LCAU, and Illinois Safe Schools Alliance, amongst others, are trying to educate schools and different identities in just really what transgender students need to be present in school day by day. So I really do think that although access to bathrooms is a huge, huge thing for transgender students, being transgender is not just in connection to a bathroom access. There's a lot of things that go on with it and a lot of stressors that we are disregarding. And this is why we need policies in place. And we really need to think of transgender students as just students that are trying to get an education and that are just seeking accessible help and just guidance to do what they need to do in school and really put the fact that they're transgender in the back of their heads while they're just trying to learn different things in school and give them the chance to just be students like everybody else in school.
Thanks for that. That's Jordy Yanez, a Central Illinois Program Coordinator with the Illinois Safe Schools Alliance, joining us from Peoria, and from Chicago, Christopher Clark, an attorney with Lambda Legal. Chris, Jordy, thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Yesterday, as you just heard them mention, a national organization, the Alliance Defending Freedom, and the Thomas More Society did file a lawsuit on behalf of 51 families from the Chicago suburbs against the Department of Education and District 211. That high school district includes Palatine, Schaumburg, Hoffman Estates. The people filing the lawsuit say these new policies are a violation of students' privacy in Title IX and that it doesn't apply to gender identity. Joining me now is the lead attorney on that suit, Jeremy Tedesco. Jeremy, welcome to the 21st. Thanks for being with us.
Yeah, thanks for having us on. I appreciate it.
So there have been a couple cases, as you probably just heard the guest say, making the previous guest saying that the Title IX argument that you all are making, that federal that Title IX does apply to trans students, they're saying that there's already a precedent. Federal appeals courts have already said that Title IX does apply. So why are you all using that as part of your legal basis for what you all filed yesterday?
Well, you know, a couple points about that. First of all, that federal court that they're talking about is a complete outlier. That decision's already going to be appealed higher up the court system. Every other court that's looked at the question of whether Title IX applies to gender identity, whether it includes gender identity protections, have said that it does not. And so, you know, we're well within, what every other court has found on that issue. But here's the bigger point. The bigger point is, the Department of Education has absolutely no authority to redefine terms and statutes. They're running rogue in this context by saying, just basically by fiat, we're going to reinterpret what a statute means or what terms in a statute mean. We're going to say that sex, which is always, for the 40-plus year history of Title IX, has always meant binary, male, female. All these courts have rejected that it includes gender identity. And yet the Department of Education comes in and ignores the will of Congress, ignores all these courts, ignores constitutional rights to privacy for students, and just decrees, nope, it includes gender identity.
But Jeremy, what about, can I stop you for a second and just ask you about, so that's the Department of Education, but I wonder what about with the Justice Department also saying, just apart from Title IX, if the Justice Department is also saying for the state of North Carolina that bathroom law would violate, that you think that's a whole other argument?
No, they're only saying that because the Department of Education has issued this unlawful redefinition of sex under Title IX. The only authority the DOJ has to say that Title IX covers gender identity is the Department of Education's unlawful redefinition of sex under Title IX. There's no other authority for that.
What are parents involved in this lawsuit telling you? What did they say yesterday in terms of why they wanted to file this suit?
Well, what they're saying is that schools have a duty to protect the privacy, safety, and dignity of all students at school. Not, and what School District 211 and the Department of Education has done is completely trampled the privacy rights of girls and boys at the school, but especially girls, because girls are the only students in the school who have to have someone of the opposite biological sex in their locker rooms. Boys don't have to deal with that. And boys don't have to find some other kind of accommodation at the school to take care of their needs for privacy. Look, Title IX says that you can have separate locker room, restroom, and shower facilities on the basis of sex. So you can have male facilities and you can have female facilities. But to the extent that you do that, they have to be comparable. Well, these aren't comparable facilities. The girls have to have a male student in their locker room. The boys do not have to have a female student.
So what's your response to, we just heard the Lambda legal attorney just say that there are privacy, areas that people, and I think when we think about, as the Lambda legal attorney said, when we think about kids changing in a locker room, people are probably trying to do that as fast as possible and be as private as possible about it. What's your response to the fact that if there are areas for people who want to be private to go into that, do you still feel like it's a violation of privacy?
Absolutely. You know, that whole argument is just tone deaf to the
privacy concerns. Why is
that? Because the right to privacy prevents the government from putting you in a situation where you can even risk the exposure of your unclothed or partially unclothed body to the opposite sex. But practically, let's look at that District 211. Practically at District 211, those privacy stalls that they put into place are in the middle of the locker room. So if a biological male student has access to the locker room and uses those stalls, he still walks through the entire locker room, uses them, and exits while girls are in the state of various states of undress getting ready for PE class.
Jeremy, we just have about a minute left, so I just want to make sure. Yeah, I just want to make sure I have time for you to answer this question completely, because we heard Lambda Legal and the other gentleman from Illinois Safe Schools Alliance say that he feels like trans advocates feel like there's a lack of education around trans students. Would you agree with that in terms of what parents have said to you, what you think this lawsuit represents? Do you feel like a lack of education is a problem here?
No, I don't think so at all. I think that what's going on here is that there's another set of interests, constitutionally protected interests here, the right to privacy of these students at school in these kinds of intimate settings. And so we have to figure out a way to protect all students' privacy, safety, and dignity at school. These kinds of policies that allow opposite-sex students into the restrooms and locker rooms of the other sex definitely violate those rights. There's a path forward. There's accommodations that can be provided to meet the interests of all students. But as far as the parents in our lawsuit are concerned and the students that are plaintiffs in our lawsuit, one of the options that can't be on the table because of their right to privacy is inserting a student of the opposite sex into their locker room and restroom.
That's Jeremy Tedesco, lead attorney for, he's a senior counsel with the Alliance Defending Freedom, lead attorney with the lawsuit that was filed yesterday against District 211, Northwest Chicago suburbs, including Palatine, Schaumburg, Hofburg Estates, and the Department of Education. Jeremy, thank you for being with us.
Thanks for having us on.
You're listening to The 21st.
The 21st is made possible by Custer & Bradley, LLP, providing legal service to the Urbana-Champaign community since 1895. Custer & Bradley's attorneys are committed to achieving the best results for their clients. More information is available at CusterLawLLP.com.
Thanks for listening to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Yesterday, Governor Rauner and the directors of six state agencies were sued by a coalition of 64 social service groups who are fed up with the state budget impasse. They say the state owes them more than $100 million for services, and it's a breach of contract. Andrea Durbin is coalition chair of the Pay Now Illinois Coalition and joins us now. Andrea, welcome to The 21st.
Hello. Thank you for having me.
Now, you're also CEO of the Illinois Collaboration on Youth, in addition to being the chair of this coalition. Who are some of the groups, or what are the different groups involved in this suit?
Sure. So, you know, we started looking at the Illinois Collaboration on Youth providers, and we realized that really this wasn't about any one population, but this was more about doing business in Illinois, and is the state honoring the contracts that it's issued. And so, you know, that becomes an issue bigger than just any one population or one service. And so we have providers from, you know, folks who are working with pregnant mothers, that's the Pediatric AIDS Chicago Prevention Initiative, to folks who are working with senior citizens, several senior helpers, Senior Service Plus,
and all throughout the state? Is this all
throughout the state? Every community, from the far northwest corner, the Sinisippi centers, down to the far southern parts of Illinois, in Centerstone of Illinois, and Family Counseling Center, which are in the very farthest, most southern parts of Illinois. So we're corner to corner.
Andrew, the governor's office released a statement yesterday in part that said the lawsuit was really just about frustration, seeking organizations to find solutions elsewhere. What's your response to that?
Well, certainly we are frustrated, but I think more we're just asking the state to pay us for services rendered. This is a business decision. This is about how Illinois does business. Good business is paying your bills, honoring legal contracts, and the state has not been doing that. And so we are just asking them to do their part. We've been doing our part.
We've heard a lot about actual cuts to social service groups. I'm curious what you think is the economic ripple effect you're seeing in communities of these agencies not being paid.
Well, you know, the ripple effects are many. They start certainly with the clients that, you know, lose access to services. Not to mention the employees who lose their jobs when, you know, there's layoffs. Many of our providers are economic engines in their community. They leverage additional resources and, you know, through other grants and contracts to enrich the community. But even more powerfully, the impact of this is on budget or business in general. Who wants to do business in Illinois if we become known as a state that doesn't honor legal contracts?
Well, prior to this, there was already a backlog. Illinois was sort of known for being very, very late in payments to social service groups and to lots of different groups. So I wonder how this not being paid compares to the backlog many agencies were facing even before this.
Certainly, you're correct in that we've had experience with backlogs before, but nothing like this. We are 300 days or more into the fiscal year. People haven't been paid one dime for the work they've done, and we deserve to be paid. You know, this non-payment has tremendous impacts on our own business. We have bank relationships. We have lines of credit. We have mortgages and leases. We have other funders that we're accountable to. Our auditors are looking at our books. All this has an impact on how we do business.
What's your goal with this lawsuit, Andrea?
Plain and simple, our goal is to be paid in full.
That's Andrea Durbin. She's coalition chair of the Pay Now Illinois Coalition. She's also chief executive officer of the Illinois Collaboration on Youth. Andrea, thanks for being with us.
Oh, I'm happy. Thanks. Bye-bye.
You're listening to The 21st. Thank you. All right, we've covered a lot of heavy subjects this hour. That's why we wanted to talk about bison. We're making the headlines last week when the House and Senate both approved a bill, the National Bison Legacy Act, to name beasts who are not buffalo the national mammal. How's that for bipartisan support? There was, however, a little bit of a backlash from late-night comedians about the announcement that bison might become the national mammal. Here's Stephen Colbert.
No disrespect to our friend the bison, but if there's a national mammal, it is us. We built the railroad. The American human put the first human on the moon. The American human wrote, "You give love a bad name." And that is not even Bon Jovi's best song, but still way better than any song any bison ever wrote.
Which, of course, brings us to particle physics. What, you say, do particle physics have in common with bison conservation? Well, it turns out they're both part of the mission at Fermi National Accelerator Lab in Batavia, Illinois. Joining us to explain is Rod Walton. He's an environmental consultant for Fermi Lab. Hey, Rod, welcome to the 21st.
Well, thank you. Thank you for having me.
I feel like I first have to ask you if you think it's unfair that the bison beat out humans in being named the national mammal. I feel like as an environmental consultant, I'm going to know what your answer is on this, but...
Well, I don't know. On the other hand, I guess the bison haven't done a whole lot of damage in their history.
Okay. Are bison native to Illinois?
Yes, they are.
Okay. Yeah. So can you give us a brief history refresher what happened when bison once roamed Illinois?
Well, at one time, there were anywhere from 20 to 60 million bison roaming the center part of the United States, ranging as far east as even Ohio. But certainly Illinois was part of that range. And the bison were very important to the ecology of the area, primarily being an integral part of the prairie ecosystem. And, you know, they eat the prairie plants.
Is that why? Okay.
Yeah, they have a role in just, you know, just because they walk all over the prairie, that affects the way it works. And also, of course, in pre-settlement times, the bison had a very close relationship with Native Americans as food and as a part of their spiritual lives. And so really, the bison are really, in a way, uniquely American.
And bison are also native to North America. That's correct, right?
That's correct.
What's the difference between bison or buffalo?
Well, bison is a different sort of taxonomic grouping from buffalo. Buffalo are primarily an old world species. They exist in Africa and to some extent, at least historically, in Europe. Things like the water buffalo and wildebeest and things like that are technically our buffalo, whereas the bison, there really are only two species of bison left, the bison, which is the American bison, and then the European bison, which is very reduced in numbers, but it still exists.
I'm speaking with Rod Walton. He's an environmental consultant with Fermi National Accelerator Lab in Batavia. And, of course, that's a particle physics lab, which has this massive particle accelerator underground. But above ground, you will have a herd of bison. What kind of bison do you have there, and how did this come about?
Well, these are, again, American bison. They have been here since the lab began back in the late 1960s. The first director of our laboratory, Robert Wilson, came to the lab from Wyoming. He was a bona fide cowboy, I think it's fair to say. And his idea in bringing bison to the lab was just to recognize the prairie heritage of Illinois and to have them become a part of the Fermilab brand, if you will, and have them be sort of an iconic symbol of the lab. And it also, over the years, it's completely consistent with our overall land management strategy. You know, we have 1,000 acres of restored tall grass prairie here at the lab, and the bison fit right into that.
And how many bison are there?
Right now we maintain a herd of 17 adult bison. We have 15 females and 2 males. And that's a number that we maintain over the years. And then we have, during the year, we have calves that are born.
So when you say you maintain them, do you mean you're specifically keeping that number pretty low?
Yes.
Why is that?
Yes. At one time, probably 20 years ago, we had many more than that, but just in terms of maintaining them and keeping within our budgetary constraints, we've reduced the herd somewhat.
So do you interact with this herd? Does anyone interact with this herd? Is that safe to do?
Yes, it is safe, but it's not safe for everybody to do.
Okay. Any visitors to Fermi, should, if they see a bison, should not run up to them.
Should not try to pet it.
Okay.
No, that's right.
Okay.
We do have a person in our grounds department who's designated as the herdsman, and it's his job to take care of the bison and to manage them, to look after them. We do supplemental feeding with them, especially in the wintertime. So he sort of acts as the caretaker of the herd.
Okay, and I understand it's calving season right now?
It is.
So how many baby bison have been born so far?
We have, as of this morning, the last time I checked, we had 5.
How many more are you expecting?
I think we probably would expect 1 per female, so we might have up to 10 more.
Oh, okay. And then, what happens to the, should I ask, what happens to the calves when they grow up, or...
Well,
are there bison burgers on the menu at Fermi Lab? Am I correct?
Well, if there are bison burgers, they're not our bison.
Okay, well, that's good to know. That's important for everyone to know. Okay.
But we do sell off the newborn, not the newborns, but in the fall of every year, we sell off the young of the year, and that's primarily just to avoid the possibility of inbreeding among the herd.
That's right. You all recently did some genetic testing to find out how genetically pure the bison are in your herd. What did you find out?
Well, we found out, it was very good news for us, we found out that all the bison we have here are 100% bison genes. The reason we're interested in that, of course, is because back almost 100 years ago, there were some experimental programs done to try and interbreed cattle and bison.
Oh.
And it was partially successful, not a great success. But as a result, there are still some cattle genes floating around in the bison gene pool.
Are they in the Fermilab bison?
No, that's why we wanted to have them tested genetically, and they found we tested 17, all 17 of our animals, and all of them came up with no cattle genes.
That's Rod Walton, an environmental consultant for Fermilab, explaining the connection in Batavia with particle physics to bison conservation. And I guess, is everybody at Fermilab now cheering for bison to become the national mammal, Rod?
I think so, yeah.
All right. Thanks for being with us.
Oh, you're welcome. It's my pleasure.
Holocaust Remembrance Day began at sundown yesterday evening. Yom HaShoah is a day to remember the 6 million Jewish victims who died during the Holocaust. Tonight, the Illinois Holocaust Museum and Education Center in Skokie has 2 commemorations at 4 and 7 p.m. tonight. They'll include American-Israeli pianist Renana Gutman performing part of Victor Ullmann's Piano Sonata No. 7. Ullmann composed this piece while imprisoned in a concentration camp. He died a few months after he wrote it at Auschwitz. Let's listen to Renana Gutman performing that piano sonata at Nicholas Concert Hall in Evanston a few years ago.
Thank you.
That's American-Israeli Renana Gutman performing part of Victor Ullmann's Piano Sonata No. 7. She'll be doing that tonight at the Illinois Holocaust Museum and Education Center in Skokie as part of their commemorations of Holocaust Remembrance Day. That does it for The 21st Show today. Thanks for listening. You can always find us on Facebook. Search for The 21st Show. You can tweet to us as well. Our Twitter handle is 21STShow. Thanks for listening. I'm Nyla Boodoo.